welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're hearing from Nobel Peace Prize-nominated author Sheila Watt Cloutier. She speaks about the environment, the economy, foreign policy, global health, and sustainability, all as one issue that affects everyone. This event took place on April 7th at the Hilton Hotel and was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. Dr. Daley Sambu-Duro, Associate Professor at the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage, provides the introduction.
As soon as I learned that Sheila had been invited to and accepted the invitation to give a keynote address at the forthcoming Alaska Native Studies Conference being hosted by University of Alaska Fairbanks this coming weekend, beginning Friday and continuing Saturday and Sunday, I moved faster than the speed of light to ensure that we could capture her here in Anchorage for at least 72 hours in order to visit the University of Alaska Anchorage campus, as well as present here today at the Alaska World Affairs Council. So I don't want to do a long formal introduction. There is quite a lot of information on the Alaska World Affairs Council website and background about Sheila, but I think it is absolutely important to recognize her early work as a student counselor, as an individual that has been an advocate for Inuit education from a very young age. She continues with that in terms of mentoring master's and PhD students through the Trudeau Foundation. In addition, she had an extraordinary career and left a mark on the Makovic Corporation, where she was responsible for management and administration as the corporate secretary of the Makovic Corporation, which was an economic development corporation established by the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement of 1975. And that was indeed quite political work. And I think an important segue into her very significant work on behalf of Inuit and the advocacy and leadership and diplomacy that she expressed as an important leader of the Inuit Circumpolar Council. Many of you in the room are familiar with the Inuit Circumpolar Council, a non-governmental organization that represents 156,000 Inuit from the Russian Far East throughout Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. In her leadership position of that organization, and in particular as the international chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council, she left an important mark and an important legacy, which we'll hear about today in her presentation of important dimensions of the book, The Right to Be Cold. Significantly, Sheila is responsible for, in a nutshell, putting the human face on the impact, the adverse impacts of climate change, especially in the Arctic and especially upon our people, the Inuit of the circumpolar region, as well, of course, the impacts upon Indigenous peoples across the globe. And I think this was an extraordinary and important linkage between the impacts of climate change and human beings, and you'll hear her amplify that particular and important message. In fact, if one takes a look at the Paris Agreement that was lauded as an important international agreement, it is extremely unfortunate that there's only a single reference to Indigenous peoples in the Paris Agreement and only a single reference to human rights in the Paris Agreement. So yes, we can all welcome it in terms of the world community, but at the same time, I think they underplayed the important human dimension of the impacts of climate change, which was essentially pioneered by our extraordinary speaker today. So without further ado, allow me to welcome Sheila Watt Cloutier to the podium. Kuyanami.
Nakomiki lunasi, Okausiganik, Atulaka Lunga Sungama, Ulakut, Ulukut, Inokatike, Inokatika.
Thank you for having me here today. It's been a while since I was in Alaska. I think the last time I was here was when I finished my term as ICC chair in 2006, so it really has been a long while. And when I was invited to Fairbanks to speak and deliver a keynote there for tomorrow, I messaged Daly and said, I want to come to Anchorage first and reconnect with friends and with former colleagues and with my, who I consider my sister, Patricia Cochran, and Daly and others. So it's good to be here, and I'm very pleased. So I'm thanking both Daly and, of course, those from the World Affairs Council here for making this happen to have me come and speak to you. I was a little bit... and I don't want to waste too much time because I realize it's shorter than I thought I had. So, but as I was preparing my notes, I was thinking that I had a little bit more time. So I'm going to shorten what I had thought I would present today, but I think I can do it in a fairly short period of time and bring you that human dimension, the human face, and the human rights angle that I have worked on for so many years. I'm originally from Koudjouak, a little community in northern Quebec, where I spent most of my childhood, or a part of my childhood anyway, until I was sent away for school, and traveled only by dog team the first 10 years of my life. And I didn't know any English until I was 6 years old. And then off I was sent at the age of 10, and for 8 years I was away from home, having lost my language and my connection to my family for a long period of time, and had to gain all of that back. But I want to start first by acknowledging that I speak on the traditional lands of the Dene here, and I'm honored to do that. For me, as I've always said, you know, as Indigenous peoples, we are all very connected around the world, and we're all dealing with the same issues here. And our rights as Indigenous people are one and the same, and as our human, environmental, and cultural rights, because everything is interconnected. There's no doubt about that. And the work that I have done in bringing the human face to the issue started off, before that, of course, I was working on, as Daly mentioned in my in her introduction, I worked on education issues, on trying to figure out why, even after signing of our land claims, why we were still struggling with many of our youth and the issues that we were faced with, the challenges. Why, after having our own institutions in place, or seemingly our own institutions in place, were we struggling so much still? And why were the suicide rates not lowering? And why were they getting even higher? And why were our kids not making it so much in the high school systems when they went past high school and on to post-secondary? So we started to ask some very serious questions about what was happening there. And we created a Nunavik Education Task Force that looked at these issues and tried to make the strong connection that somehow the schooling system was failing our kids, and our kids were not necessarily the ones failing. And so we looked at that and came out with 101 recommendations for change. In fact, in the book, as I say, we wanted to change everything. But yet it was, you know, it was a very difficult and daunting task, because we got very entrenched in institutional learning very quickly, even though for us, the way in which we prepare and teach our children for the opportunities and challenges of life are not so siloed and not so entrenched in ways that are not helpful, really, in many ways to how our children can be prepared for the modern world. So from that moment on, I learned a great deal about how systems work in that sense, and how education systems work or not work for many students. And so we felt that at the end of the day, we didn't want to be replicating wheels that were not working even for many southern schools, much less northern schools, for our own children. So it was a real uphill climb, and that was a big part of the book that I've written in the chapter there is about fighting for that right education for our kids. And there it started, and I became more and more verbal about some of these things and making the connection of how we've got to redo and reclaim our sense of self, and that our culture really has a lot of remarkable, brilliant, ingenious ways in which we can still tap into and replicate that in system somehow. And so we did come out with a very strong report called The Pathway to Wisdom, Sila Tunermut, in our language. And that was the beginning of me stepping up and to the plate and being more verbal about some of these things that really have a great deal of meaning for us. And because it's really about our kids and trying to prepare them for all of these changes that happen so very rapidly. And then I went on to work on... I had never in my entire life wanted to enter into the arena of politics. You never can never say never in your life because somehow your life's work finds you. Whether you want it or like it or not, it finds you. And after this work that we had done on the task force work on education, then I decided that I think I needed some kind of a political platform to work on these issues. And a political power base to make more effective changes. And so I ran. In the first term, I didn't get in. Then 3 years later, I got in with McKivitt Corporation and started to work on youth issues again and developed, in fact, a video to Capturing Spirit, the Inuit Journey, to try to, using some... special effects, a talking Inukshuk with an elder, a talking Arctic Tern that was bringing and weaving the story together and so on, so that it could reach out to the youth once again. And I know that Alaska used that video several times in the past, and I don't know if they're still using it. Someone's nodding their head, so I think you might know what that is. And so I was very pleased about that. That Alaska and I think Greenland took it up as well. It's called Capturing Spirit, the Inuit Journey. And from then on, that's when I started to work on and got elected to work on with ICC. I was elected to head. I went up to Bear, Alaska, Nome, Alaska, at that time, as a delegate from my region. Very green in the political arena. I had just been elected in March, and in July I was in Nome. And again, I was being verbal about some of the things that I felt were important on the floor, and before I knew it, I was being elected as ICC Canada President, the Executive Council member for the ICC, and came home with two mandates, a regional one and an international one. And it was around the time that the work of the intergovernmental negotiations were starting up on the persistent organic pollutants that were poisoning our food chain, where we had learned through much work here in Alaska as well, of course. Patricia has been doing that work for many, many years. And in Canada, you know, there had been a lot of research being done in connecting the persistent organic pollutants that were finding their way up in the Arctic and into our food chains and into the nursing milk of our mothers. And as a mother myself, and I was to become a grandmother shortly after that, it was really a no-brainer to think that we had to do something very urgently about this matter, because it, you know, this issue of persistent organic pollutants was not just an issue of a chemical story. It wasn't just about toxins that were finding their way up and it becoming an environmental issue. This was first and foremost a health issue for us. And the urgency of the matter was one that we needed to address quickly. Now, to make a long story short, as I say, with the limited time I have, we mobilized ourselves fairly quickly, and McGill University in Montreal set up the Center for Indigenous Nutrition and Environment and started a lot of the blood work that was required to really create that database on what does this mean in terms of the poisoning of our bodies and the nursing milk of our mothers. And many of us became board members of, including ICC, of CINI, and then ITK, the Inuit Dapereit Canadami from our region, our national body, who now is headed by Natan Obed, and I just met his cousin over there, Susan. In those years, as I say, for us the urgency was really clear. It was about health, and so ITK also set up departments that would then monitor a lot of this stuff, work with Health Canada and Industry Canada and so on. Anyway, to fast-track this whole process, when I was elected with ICC Canada, then the negotiations were starting up. So there's a whole chapter in there, and I you know, and as I say, I'm shortcutting a lot of this, and I'm not going to go into my script now at this point because there may not be enough time to go into a lot of the detail. It was a time where the world barely knew who we were in the Arctic, much less the kinds of negative impacts globalization was having on us and industry was having on us. As we know, these toxins that were making their way up through the weather patterns was something that, you know, it's almost like a science fiction movie. I mean, how could you possibly believe that far away from the source, you know, where we are furthest away from the source of these toxins, became the net recipients of these toxins in our food chain? And what are we to do? How are we going to deal with the issue of not fully knowing the long-term negative impacts of these on our health? And so I became at the time the spokesperson for the coalition of the Canadian Northern Indigenous peoples, but beyond that Canadian, but there were also Russian Indigenous peoples who were very much engaged in that. Alaskans were engaged in that process as well. But I became the spokesperson at every single one of those negotiations around the world at the UN level as we helped to negotiate and influence that process by putting, as Daly says, that human face on the map. And I think when people start, you know, that gave me a great sense of hope when I was working on that issue, which led to the Stockholm Convention, because I think when we come down to, when we kind of eliminate that whole political scene, it just brings us down to the human level, and where we can come together and make a difference in how we deal with these issues by coming to common ground as a common humanity. And that, you know, the nursing milk of our mothers was a compelling, very compelling to the mothers of the world, because as we were the net recipients of these toxins, it was as a result of many of these toxins where even DDT that was helping mothers to save their babies from dying from malaria in other parts of the world, you know, here we were dealing with the mothers of the world, the North and the South, carrying the brunt of these toxins. And my message was very clear. It's how is it that the world has come to this place where the mothers are carrying the brunt of this kind of poison that we are spewing out into the atmosphere? And that, I think, brought people to their attention in many ways, in more ways than, you know, many just dry reports and can in this kind of setting. And anyone who's worked in the UN forums can fully understand how difficult it is to try to get a heartbeat into these issues, you know, much less the human dimension and the human face to that. So I feel very proud of that work with, you know, the coalition that I worked with the Dene, the Métis, the Athabascans. Lots of us were together in on this as we forged ahead in the global arena, and at the end of the day came out with a convention that was very helpful to eliminating these toxins at their source, because it wasn't about managing these toxins. It was really clearly about needing to eliminate them at their source. And that's what we were able to do with the signing of the Stockholm Convention. And I think today we can say that, not that we're dancing in the streets, because there's always new chemicals coming into the play, and that we can't be complacent about it. We can't be putting this on the back burner. We've got to be still very diligent about you know, how even flame retardants that we now see in our polar bears, it's still ongoing. We've got to keep that on the front burner. But certainly there are many data now and science that indicates that there is less of these toxins in our country food, which is a good thing. There are other factors to this whole story of POPs that I won't get into now that are still very alarming in terms of how we may have eliminated these at their source, but there's still a huge lot of stockpiles of these stuff around that somehow are also being used and sold and so on. And there are still people in some of the more vulnerable countries that are still being negatively impacted by it. And that led me to... you know, as ICC, we're a very small organization, very limited resources, and those of, you know, we're working as though we're working with, you know, hundreds of staff and so on. No, we're usually like three or four or five in an office, you know, in each country, and we're spending a lot of our time trying to get out there to the world to deal with the global community on these issues. And we have to be there in person to do this work, or else you just don't get ahead in terms of, you know, telling the compelling story and really advocating for your people so that it can make a difference in the policy changes internationally that then can affect the health and well-being of your people. So with the limited resources, it was always very difficult to be dealing with a lot of issues all at once. And once the POPs Treaty was signed, I mean, it was one of the fastest UN treaties, by the way, to have been signed, ratified, and enforced, which again shows the promise of or the encouragement that I received, thinking that the world is still a pretty good place when it can act this quickly. But I was not in any kind of illusion or dreamland in thinking that the issues of climate change were going to be, you know, easier, or just as not to say that POP's work was easy, but the climate change issues we knew up and coming were going to be very difficult to deal with, because we had, you know, big, powerful countries like the United States in those years, definitely, and I won't get into the present too much right now today, in those days we were really dealing with an administration that really, if one American was going to lose a job, there was no way they were going to change their economic or environmental policies whatsoever. And when we were starting the work at the Arctic Council level on the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, where, by the way, the United States was really heading this work. The Secretariat, I believe, was in Fairbanks. There were many, many American, great American scientists that were involved in this. I think we were 15 countries that were involved in all of this, with 350 some odd scientists that teamed together and worked on the science of climate change in the circumpolar world. And in those years, we had we had a huge void in the science of climate change in those years. This was even before the IPCC reports were coming out and so on. And so when the ACIA came out, it was a strong and powerful, stark reality of the science of climate change, and particularly in the circumpolar world. And during that work, I realized, and many of us realized, the uphill climb we were going to have in trying to keep that human face and the human dimension to this issue of climate change. You'll have to read the book to read the details of that interesting times that we all had, for many of us that were working on this issue, during a time when the politics again kicked in to somehow stall the report from coming out on time before a November election, that the policy document that we had already been approved by the ministers of every one of those countries involved in the Arctic Council were then, during the halfway through the work, there were players that started to try to change the course of those what we were trying to achieve in terms of a policy document that would be attached to the science documents itself. And that was an interesting ride. And I just spoke to someone, signed a book for someone who mentioned at the time my advisor, Terry Fenge, who passed away last November very suddenly, was during a time where we were really had our you know, we dug in deep, and Terry, being a wonderful, brilliant, smart thinker that he was very engaged and involved in all of that. So in the end of the day, we did get the document out, and it was that we started to think about how we had to go beyond just putting the human face on the map in dealing with this issue of climate change. And, you know, one of the things that I've come to, and my journey, this book is really about my journey and some of the things where the human journey and how you are given indications and signs, you know, not to be, and I don't want you to interpret this as New Agey, because it's really more about the indigenous way in which we see the world view as well. It's very much connected to that as well, where if you're open to your journey and your path, you are shown that there's a cosmic order to life, and I really believe that. And so here we were dealing with some of these issues, and one of my board members, I recall, and I write about that, Peter Adam, he said, you know, here we are being poisoned from afar, our food chain being poisoned. Here, you know, at the ozone layer up in the Arctic is widening as a result of all of these, toxic issues. We're getting more and more skin cancers and cataracts and so on as a result of that, because we hunt out there in the hot spring sun and so on with very little protection. And now our climate is changing so fast that we are being very negatively impacted as a result of what's happening. What do we need to do? And he said, do we have to launch lawsuits against big companies? What do we have to do? And, you know, when you're elected, you think about these things and you think, you know, what are the ways in which we can really start to get the world to understand that this is indeed a real human issue? This isn't just about the polar bears and the ice. This is about the human communities in our communities that are already in a very vulnerable situation, where the historical traumas and the tumultuous changes that have made it so that we are worried about every single day about how we're losing our youth to suicides and to abuse and self-destruction in more numbers than anywhere else in North America. What is it that we need to do to address this issue, to make it even stronger in terms of our stances to deal with these issues? And, you know, as you're thinking, and that's what I mean by the cosmic order to life, you realize that other people in the world are also thinking in those terms. And not necessarily indigenous people, but people who have been thinking about these issues. And Terry, who said to me one night, he says, after a big event, and we'd been thinking about a lot of these things, and I've been thinking about what one of my board members had said, he said, I think we should be meeting these people. I've received some contacts from the Center for Environmental International Law, CL, in Washington based, and Earth Justice in San Francisco. And they have made the legal linkage between climate change and human rights. And they know of your work because Dan, who was heading CL in Washington at the time, had known of my work, and we've worked together in the international arena. So they'd like to meet with you on these issues. And off after an event in Washington, off we went, because for me, our history of well-intended animal rights people, well-intended conservationists, we have a terrible history as a result of some of that, where our way of life was destroyed by many of the good intentions of many people in those arenas. You know, the sealing industry. We're not commercial hunters, but nonetheless are hunters during that period of time in transition. We're making very good money to support their families by the byproduct of our subsistence hunt. And boom, overnight, Bridget Bardot came over from France and other people, and off, you know, the dignity to provide for your families was gone. Our hunters were completely demoralized by this, and we still continue to fight these issues. And so a lot of these issues of the historical traumas we're already in this vulnerable place, and here we are dealing with the new waves that were coming at us, you know, the environmental degradation, the climate change, all of these issues. And it was then that we started as a team, really started to look at these issues, and we met with Ciel, we met with Earth Justice, and we thought, and then Terry said, you know, I think we better think about this, because there's a huge implication to all of this. If you decide to go with this, we're going to go 100%. And I knew that. And I knew that that this would be a real challenge at that time. We knew with the challenge we had with the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment work, it was going to be a real daunting task to really put this out as a human rights issue. But nonetheless, we did. When I spoke with Don Goldberg I keep forgetting names now. I must be aging. Martin Wagner from Earth Justice. It was, these were moments where, you know, often that we are very cautious, as I say, to well-intended folks who are not from our regions, who don't fully have really experienced the lives that we live. And not to build on mistrust, but because of that history, we've got to be very cautious. And our boards always caution us not to be sleeping with the enemy, so to speak, you know? And so, not that I try to see anybody as an enemy, but nonetheless, it was one of those moments where I was interviewing them as much as they were trying to see whether I would become their client, so to speak, or Inuit would become their client. And it felt right, because for me, I was asking them the questions about who they were, not what they were, but who they were. Who's your children? What do you do in your life? What are your values? What are your principles? Who are you? And I felt like they were good people to work with at the end of the day, and we started to move in that direction. Of course, we had challenges along the way, even amongst our own people, because people were afraid that if we go, and this, by the way, was a legal petition that we were after, that we were going to be developing this legal petition. Not just signature of names, but a legal petition that would then connect human rights and climate change to human rights, and that we would be seeking a declaration from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, Washington-based, to say indeed the inaction of the United States administration at the time was violating the human rights of Inuit of the Arctic by not taking action to lower their greenhouse gas emissions. That was the whole point. And it was not a lawsuit because we didn't want to go that way. We didn't want it to become an issue of money and for people to use that as an excuse not to take action, further action. How much more time do I have? Do I have a few more minutes? 4 minutes? Okay. So, and that's how we proceeded. It took 2 years to prepare this work. A remarkable piece of work that you can download from earthjustice.org, 167 pages, with hundreds of footnotes. So you can imagine the work that went into that. And you can download it. And if you click onto Inuit petition, then you'll be able to have an appreciation of the work that went into that. And the voices of the hunters from Canada and Alaska that we put on tape. Testimony. We had two young students. It's interesting, we launched this petition targeting the United States, but the two organizations I worked with were American. One Harvard and one Dartmouth College student were American. And so we were just this, you know, American-Canadian connection that was going on here to do the right thing. And of course, the Civil Society of America were ahead of their administration at the time and were wanting to do the right thing. So we knew we had a backing of a lot of Americans, and we knew that the scientists that were American that had worked on these issues at the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment work were definitely behind us in all of this. So we did, after 2 years of preparation and going to several of these COP meetings, we launched the petition in Montreal at COP 15, I believe. And then we waited and waited and waited. And finally, after a long period of time, we had a response from the commission saying, a very short, brief letter saying, we cannot go further with this petition. And being persistent that our team was, and I am, we kept writing and saying, "This, you can't dismiss this. This cannot be dismissed." And eventually they said, "Okay, we will hear you in a first hearing, a testimony connecting climate change to human rights on the legal implications to come." So I went down with my legal team and testified. And again, that testimony is in the earthjustice.org if you want to see that. At the end of the day, even though the commission head said that they would go ahead with this, didn't, and we never heard back from them. And my term was ending as chair. But what happened in the end with this is, even though the declaration was not declared, I believe that we helped to change the discourse on this issue globally, where climate change not only was had the human face to it and a human dimension, but indeed it was a human rights issue. And in that respect, I think our work was well done in that way. And it has been going since. I mean, I haven't stopped since. I left elected politics in 2006, but I remain extremely busy with that. I started to write the book a few years ago, and now it's starting to fly. It didn't lift off until about maybe 3 months ago, when it was shortlisted for the CBC Canada Reads. Even my own Canadians weren't picking it up, you know? And so you go, okay, what more do we have to do here? But when the CBC Canada Reads shortlisted it, and then they had these public debates, you know, and so on, then it started to lift off. So I'm very pleased about that, very pleased that it's getting there. And I'm now hopefully working on, which has been very tough to try to get, an American publication, very tough to get. But now there seems to be two that may be interested because of the CBC Canada Reads, that more people are more aware of it, that we're in it together, and that all of the things that are happening in the Arctic don't stay in the Arctic, that it's, you know, whatever, wherever the ice is melting, the glaciers and so on in the Arctic are affecting everywhere else. And so, of course, the droughts and the floods and the hurricanes, the intensity of all of these storms that are happening, including the wildfires in Canada, are all connected to that air conditioner that's breaking down for the planet, which happens to be the Arctic ice and the glaciers. And that connection is more clear than any other time in history. But yet, we have leaders who now say, no, out the door, out the window. You know, with the crucial things that are happening. So it is an honor, as always, to be speaking to Americans who are thinking more deeply about these issues and who see the urgency of these matters. And it's been a real joy to be back here in Anchorage. And thank you for having me. I'm just, again, there's lots more to say, but you know what? You might be able to get it more in the book. So thank you. Thank you.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing from Sheila Watt Cloutier, author of The Right to be Cold, One Woman's Story of Protecting Her Culture, the Arctic, and the Whole Planet. This event was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council at the Hilton Hotel on April 7th. We return to the program as she takes questions from the audience.
So I'm going to try to draw you out to talk about the current political situation. As you know, the new American administration, with the full concurrence of the Alaska Congressional Delegation, by the way, is going the opposite way as a lot of the world on Arctic pollution and climate change. What's your prognosis for the immediate future on that? Do you think more progressive countries like Canada and in Northern Europe will step into the void, or what's to be done? What happens on these issues?
Yeah. Well, certainly in Canada, you know, we had same as you did. You had a lot of hope when Obama came in, and his intentions were great. But as you know, he was also paralyzed by politics to do more than he did on these issues. The same with us in Canada. We have a great prime minister, young, robust, just dynamo. But our provinces are... have their own mandates as well. I mean, Canada's a federation, and so we've got provinces that are wanting pipelines and many other ways that are many people don't see as sustainable, including many of us, of course, in the Arctic, who are most impacted by that. It is difficult to say. I really don't try to get into the politics of things in my talks, but nonetheless, the move, and I've said this yesterday, any changes that I think that are really going to happen now that deals with our planet in crisis, actually our planet in trauma, it's no longer changes, it's trauma. And in the same way that our Aboriginal communities have been in trauma for a long time, so too now is our climate, our planet. And we have to deal with it as such. I think the movement is not going to be in politics. It will be in all of us. And if we can just continue to really press hard, not necessarily even leadership, because they are paralyzed by partisan politics and so on, that we need to do, whether it's in our municipalities, our cities, our counties, our states, our provinces, just keep plugging away at making those changes and lowering those emissions in everything we do, in our businesses, in our homes, everywhere. I know it's hard to do without the larger father of government, but at the same time, I don't know where else that movement's going to happen. And it's going to happen with the younger generation. The youth are going to be, and they already are. I've taught at Mount Allison. I taught at Bowdoin College. And I can tell you that generation is way ahead of my generation in being, I don't like to use the term, I don't use it for myself, but environmentalists and environmentalism, but advocates for the environment. That generation, I think, is where the hope lies. And it lies in civil society, in all of us, more than the political arenas. They're paralyzed by that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Sheila, thank you for your leadership on behalf of people and the planet and advocacy. About 3 weeks ago, the New Zealand government took the extraordinary decision of recognising the rights of a river as being equivalent to the rights of an individual, which may seem like a crazy idea, but I understand there's another law that recognises corporations as individuals also, so there's precedent for this kind of crazy legal thinking. And about a week later, the Indian government made a similar announcement. They declared the Ganges and another river in India as having the same rights as individuals. So we're seeing a lot of leadership around from Indigenous people around the world on trying to create this balance and new approaches. And I just wonder if you could speak a little bit about what you see across the Arctic. Are there any similar things happening where Indigenous folks are responding to new ways to the challenges of climate change?
Yes. Not just climate change, but in terms of even... If you have followed the story of this very small community in Nunavut called Clyde River, they have stood up, and they've been heard by the Supreme Court of Canada. They have stood up against seismic testing that is happening in the region where lots of our marine mammals are, and we depend on our marine mammals for our nutrition. And there has been a stop to that. They put a stop to that until the Supreme Court hears that, because the seismic testing, of course, as we know, is there as trying to find the oil that's lying below the melting ice to keep developing the Arctic. You know, because that's what's happening, is that the melting of the Arctic ice is creating this new influx of mining and oil and gas exploration. So the very thing that is causing the Arctic to melt is being the carrot that's being dangled to many vulnerable peoples of the Arctic who don't have jobs and who don't have a way in which to alleviate the poverty and so on that's up there, and the hunger that's up there. So that story has been one of inspiration for many of us who have stood up and said, no, we will not a stand for this, we need to stop this, and they've gone to the Supreme Court. They've been heard. The ruling hasn't come out yet because it takes several months for that to come. But that's one very inspirational story that is coming out from our regions in Canada on these issues. And I suspect there is more that is going to happen as a result of that. Because again, when we launched our human rights petition, it created somewhat of a movement, and there were outcrops of the rights-based approach that we took for others to stand up and launch. Even in Alaska, I think there was some launching of some lawsuits, even though they were thrown out. But it's still, because a power is in the attempt, you know, it's not always in the ultimate goal, but in the attempt as you stand up for your rights. And that gives that hope and encouragement to others to think that we can't just be complacent and we can't just be suppressed and oppressed as Indigenous peoples. And so that it's the modeling, really, that in itself is really important and makes way for the younger generation and others to say, ah, we can do this too. And there was also, and not necessarily in the Arctic, but yesterday I cited last night, the students from Oregon that launched, I think it was against climate change, against their own government on climate change for their future. And there was a young woman from Washington, D.C. who had been working on these issues for a long time on human rights, cited the fact that the Inuit petition more or less led way for that action to take place in connecting human rights, climate change, and human rights. So in that way, it may be slower or it may not look as effective as big political policies that change and so on, but I think that's where that movement lies, and I think that's where it's going to make a difference and impact.
I need a little lead time to stand up. Interestingly enough, I was thinking about this morning. I had read a series of articles, all of them dour, about Atlantic water and enhancing the melting of the ice and things like that. And I wrote down to start a small blog about, well, maybe government isn't the answer. Mm-hmm. Kind of going where David was a little bit. And I guess my question is, if government's not the answer, the thought they had that businesses are, that the marketplace and corporate reputations and sales figures and people buying products and not buying products, depending on what those organizations do, may be a bigger lever than the government. And I wondered, yeah, if you've seen something like that, what the sense that might be. Part of it is I belong to an institute. I'm a fellow at the Fowler Center for Business as an Agent of World Benefit, mm-hmm, which looks at sustainability through flourishing. And they're starting to work with businesses, and the mm-hmm flourishing aspect is the connectedness throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And that's just starting to spread. I wonder if you'd seen or have mm-hmm been able to discuss that a little
yeah
bit.
Yeah, not so much with the global community per se, but I do as much as I can to try to see what's going on out there. But certainly the younger generation or the movement within our own Inuit world in the Canadian Arctic have been saying, why are we putting all of our eggs into mining, for example? Why are the mining companies putting money into our education system so that there can be courses called Mining Matters or, you know, as early as grade 3 starting this to streamline Inuit kids to go into mining? Why aren't there other innovative, creative means in which we can find, new eco-friendlier industry and create them in the Arctic that are more of a culture match, where you have that respect for our lands and our waters and our environment, but yet be able to innovate in our world? And there are many cases of that. I mean, if you saw, for example, can I show you my shoes? They're sealskin covered shoes, right? Pardon? I just put them into a bag and I don't say a word. Now don't call customs on my way home. But yes, you can. If it's for personal use, you can. I mean, I can use my jewelry and it's no problem. There are ways in which we are the byproduct of our sealing, for example. You know, you say, well, why does it affect the Inuit world so much? Well, you know, I want to put a plug in here for this young woman who's a documentary filmmaker in our region, in Iqaluit, where I lived for 15 years. I'm now back home to my birthplace. She's amazingly smart, and she has come out with a documentary called Angry Inuk. Everybody needs to see this. If you think you have understood, and felt compassion for the seals and the baby seals that they depict, you know, as being slaughtered in Canada and so on, please watch this film. It's so important because there's a lot of big money behind those movements, and not truthful. either. And this is brilliantly researched and so well made that it will educate the world. She has been winning awards for this documentary and has gone to Europe and everywhere as well, United States. And it's an important piece that many people have not fully understood the negative impact of the sealing issues for us as Inuit, and that we are, it's not the sealers who are harvesting more seals, it's Inuit who are. The numbers are there, and we do it sustainably, we do it respectfully, and we eat everything that we hunt. And the byproduct of that goes to our clothing, but it also now is starting to pick up in a modern way with beautiful clothing, coats and shoes and you name it. And that's sustainable, and it's a culture match. And there are other means that people are looking at as well in those terms. You know, we've got the windiest places in the Arctic. Why wouldn't we be tapping into solar, wind and solar? And we have long periods of time where there's lots of sunshine. Many ways that we haven't even started to tap into, because we're just so busy trying to survive the day with the social and health problems that we're faced with. And now we need to address those issues so that we can bring back the innovation. And I say this all the time in my talks. We as Inuit are, after all, are the inventors of the Hayak, which is worldwide replicated as one of the best architected or engineered boats in the world. That's our ingenuity. And it's replicated and all over the world, the Hayak. We are a people who can build a home of snow, warm enough for our babies to sleep in and our mothers to birth their babies in. That's ingenuity. Imagine the architecture of that. So we have it in us to be able to survive the greatest of odds and the harshest of environments in the entire world. So we have it, but it's the oppressed culture that we've gone through, the historical traumas, that has brought us to this place as though we were just victims of everything. But we're not. Suicides are not, the high suicide are not the natural state of our lives. That's not who we are. That's not the essence of who we are. And so we need to bring that innovation back and really just start to create a world that allows us to continue to be the sentinels and the guardians, not just for ourselves, but for the planet. Because it is that disconnect that urban settings have had now for a long time, disconnect from their food source and from each other and their environment, that we are even debating this issue of climate change in the first place. And so we have to bring that back to all of us together in that way.
I had a couple of questions. You're slowly getting there as this mic is being spread. Myself and my niece, we are representative of about 700 people from back home. Mm. Suicide is pretty rampant. It's really hard to think beyond our Yupik worldview because ours is so environmentally based.
Yeah.
And I like the way you put it, that it's using the cosmos.
Yeah.
And it is. I believe my ancestors are beside me, yep. And they're constantly pushing me in the right direction. But there is definitely a disconnect with our children. I'd like to know how to better educate our children, aside from dragging my niece so she can teach her three yeah. growing boys
yeah.
How to live correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But there is definitely a disconnect with our slum, our slak, and our yoa.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know, aside from meeting you and what you've done, you were part of my report last week because I'm a university student as well.
Yes.
I want to know what I can do as a representative of 700 people that would change Alaska for better.
Hmm. Yeah. Boy, that's a big question. I don't have the right answer for you or a prescriptive way in which we can, but I can share the journey. And that's what I've tried to do, because this book isn't a climate change book per se. It's a human journey of how one can come from humble beginnings and go through and overcome obstacles in life and contribute to one's family, one's community, one's people, one's planet, you know? And I was like everyone else, and I am like everyone else. I didn't set out to be a Nobel Peace Prize nominee, but I started in my early adult life to deal with the issues that had a hold on me. You know, the severing of my culture, being sent away from school for school at early age, the abandonment of fathers and grandfathers, all of those things. One has to, I think, address those if you're going to lead by example, by modeling. And because I felt that when I got elected, and I really had to, because you're faced with so many obstacles when you're out there trying to champion these issues for your people and to make a difference in how people perceive your world. And I knew I had to, and for a long time I had to deal with my own issues so that I could not limit and project limitations onto the very generation or people that I was to be modeling the possibilities for. So we start with self. We start with self. And every one of us has that ability to start working through those issues so that we can then radiate and project the right modeling, energy, love, care, and transfer that onto a larger playing field, the planet. And that has, for me, been my way in which I have tried to live, is trying to center, because you can be swayed so much. And in our world, as you know, there's so much going on that you can be swayed off your center. But it's to keep as much as possible to be aware and consciously aware of how we're being swayed and go back to that place where there is that real sense of strength and peace. But it does start with us, and then we can model that possibility for others. Thank you for sharing. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been hearing from Sheila Watt Cloutier, a Nobel Peace Prize nominee and author of The Right to Be Cold, One Woman's Story of Protecting Her Culture, the Arctic, and the Whole Planet. This event was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council at the Hilton Hotel on April 7th. I'm your host and producer for today's program, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.